Well, as I said, the Feast of Tabernacles is right on top of us. Many have already left for the feast, those who are going overseas, and many who are traveling different places here in the U.S., and the rest of us who are going will be leaving tonight or tomorrow morning, since the first service at the feast will be opening night tomorrow night, wherever we may be. Got to thinking about all the things we do to prepare for the Feast of Tabernacles. You know, every year in the spring of the year, we update the Feast website. We have the feast.cogba.org. The church produces material in the spring around Passover, Days of Unleavened Bread. Things start getting populated on the Feast website, and we get referred to that. There's an inaccord that talks about going there and checking out the different things that are there. And people begin to think about feast locations. Where do we want to go? What's available? What are the sites going to be this year? And that information begins to be populated on the website, all the U.S.-administered sites, along with a list of the international sites. And international sites, a lot of times, are slower getting posted, at least the details, because sometimes it takes them longer to get those details worked out. But once we have those, we post those on the website as well. But, you know, the preparation begins long before that, doesn't it? If you think about it, it's really way before that. In fact, right now, they're starting to think about the feast for next year. Are we going to be using this site that we're using this year? Is this one going to be used again next year? Are we going to look for something else? Those things seem to be almost a year-round deal, that the preparation begins very, very early. Now, I was thinking about this, that through keeping God's feast, we really get that overview of the plan of salvation that God has. We've talked a lot about that over the years in the Church of God, that we really see the basic outline, the plan of salvation that God has for mankind. And it's all described in his festivals. We know there's the fall festival season that talks about everything that's in the future, the bright future that God has for mankind. That's something that really keeps us going, something that we really look forward to, because we look at all the troubles around us in the world. And there are many. There are a lot of things going on around the world. Here in the United States, even, there's a lot of dissatisfaction. There are a lot of difficulties, a lot of problems right now. And all of these fall festivals carry a very positive, encouraging message for the future. It's kind of what keeps us going, looking forward to the future. I'd like to take a note here of what God says about this third pilgrimage festival that ancient Israel was told they were to keep. This is in Deuteronomy chapter 14. You can be turning there. But this futuristic view, which we recognize from the New Testament perspective, ancient Israel didn't have that. They were simply looking from the perspective, most of them, as best we know, they were looking simply from the physical harvest season. But this pilgrimage, and there were three times in the year that ancient Israel would travel to Jerusalem for the festivals in the spring, of course, early summer, and then here in the fall. Let's take a look at what he says to do here in Deuteronomy chapter 14, beginning in verse 22. He says, "You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year." Now, of course, this was an agrarian society, and so this is couched in that language, that a farmer goes out, he plants seed, the crop comes in, he keeps enough seed out of that to take care of what he's going to need to plant next year, and then the rest of it is increase. It's what he's gained, what is more than what he planted. And God says, truly tithe. Be careful about this. Make sure that you keep up with that 10%, that it produces year by year. Verse 23, "And," so this is what you are to do with that 10%, "and you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. The tithe of your grain, of your new wine, of your oil, the firstborn of your herds and of your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always." So he's telling us, keep 10%. Carefully keep that, truly tithe, truly keep up with it. And then you go to the feast. You go to where God has placed his name. 10% of your salary, or if you work for someone else, or net profit if you're a small business and self-employed, whatever your situation is, you take care of that 10%. But he says it's to be eaten by us. Take it to where God has placed his name to keep the festival, and then you eat it. Now, we know that that's not what God said about the tithe that went to the Levites, the one that was used to support God's work. We'll go to Numbers 18. If you want to put something here, I have this nice little remember to mute your cell phone deal. I'm going to stick in my Bible. Let's go to Numbers 18. Numbers chapter 18. And this passage is talking about the Levites and some of their responsibilities and the priesthood, their responsibilities as well. Let's pick it up in verse 21. Numbers 18, verse 21. Behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work which they perform, the work of the tabernacle of meeting. So they didn't have an inheritance of land like all of the other tribes did. They divided out the promised land. Each tribe had a certain portion of the promised land. Levi got none. The Levites didn't have any physical inheritance. And so God said, tithe from all of the other tribes. That's what I'm giving you, Levi, for you're doing my work at the tabernacle of meeting, and later, of course, the temple. Verse 22, hereafter the children of Israel shall not come near the tabernacle of meeting, lest they bear sin and die. That is into the area of the holy place, the holy part of the tabernacle. But the Levites shall perform the work of the tabernacle of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity. Well, that's a kind of a poor translation of this. If you look at some of the newer translations, they'll word this very differently. What they say is it really means they bear the full responsibility for caring for the tabernacle. And they bear the responsibility for doing it right. If they don't, then they're the ones who sin, not the people. So it's their responsibility to take care of the tabernacle the way God wanted it done. Going on in that verse, it says, it shall be a statute forever throughout your generations that among the children of Israel, they shall have no inheritance, speaking of the Levites. For the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer up as a heave offering to the Lord, I've given to the Levites as an inheritance. Therefore, I've said to them, among the children of Israel, you shall have no inheritance. So the tithes went to the Levites, and that's what they used to perform the work of God. So what sustained them, what gave them a living. So that is not the tithe that we're talking about in Deuteronomy 14. Deuteronomy chapter 14, if we go back there, and take a look at this again. Notice what he says that we are to do with this tithe. And this is not a sermon about tithing. There's a whole lot we could say about that. But you look at some of the Jewish writers, ancient writers like Josephus and different ones, and they'll point out that, yes, there were different tithes. One was to go to supply the needs of the tabernacle. The other was for the people that they were to keep so that they would be able to go to God's festivals and they would be able to enjoy the time at God's festivals. This is what was this second set of tithes, or this second tithe, or festival tithe, that God said we were to keep. Verse 23 again, you shall eat before the Lord your God. You take that and eat there in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil, the firstborn of your herds, and so forth. And verse 24, if the journey's too long for you, so that you're not able to carry the tithe, or if the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far from you when the Lord has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money. Take the money in your hand and go to the place where the Lord your God chooses, and you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. And you shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. You shall rejoice. It's a command. You've got to go have a good festival. Well, God wanted to make sure we could, so he set up a means for us to be able to finance going to the festival and enjoying some nice food, some nice drink. Now, obviously, many times in the Bible, God talks about doing things in moderation. He's not saying go get drunk. He's saying do it in moderation. Whatever we do, don't become a glutton. So everything's in moderation, but we can enjoy some nice things at the feast. This is what God wants us to do. We're commanded to rejoice. We're commanded to have a good time and to include our families in that they also enjoy the feast. So I'd like to talk a little bit more today that as we think about these final steps in preparing to rejoice at the feast, what do we need to make sure that we do or that we have done? So that we have a wonderful time at the feast, so we can rejoice and learn to respect and honor God, because that's what he says that we should do back in verse 23, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. This is why he wants us to go to these festivals, that we remember him, that we focus on him, that we respect him, we honor him. knowing that he will punish those who disobey, but that he will greatly, incredibly bless those who are faithful to him. So how do we make sure we have that really wonderful feast season? Well, first of all, we prepare financially, as I've looked at here in Deuteronomy 14. We do that all year, don't we? We start saving our second tithe from the time we come back from the feast. We set that aside. Again, you shall truly tithe. Be careful with it. For the vast majority of us, that means a paycheck. And you put 10% of that aside to save toward the feast. We start saving it right away. Again, for those who are self-employed, it's a different setup because you have to figure what your income is. It's not just how much comes in, it's how much is actually income to you. But that's an accounting matter. But again, we set aside that tithe that we are to keep. Secondly, we prepare physically. That point went pretty quickly. Physical will go pretty quickly too, because a lot of us are so experienced at traveling, aren't we? If we've been going to the feast for how many of more than 30 years? Most of you here. 50 years? I'll jump up. Oh yeah, a bunch of hands still. Any 60s? Oh yeah. Okay. So some of us have been doing this a long, long, long time. I've been doing it one less year than I am old. So that's pretty old. That's real old. But we get used to preparing for travel, don't we? We think about, okay, in the past days when you had a newspaper that would come every day, oh, I've got to stop the newspaper. Don't want a bunch of newspapers sitting around on the front yard so somebody knows I'm gone, we're not there. Stop the mail. You know, you take care of all of those physical details that so many of us have come to know over the years that it's important to do. You register for the feast wherever you're going. Obviously, that helps us plan, helps the church plan. Figure out how you're going to get there. We're going to fly. We're going to drive. Some people even fly to places where they could go by car just because it's more convenient or because there's some other issue that they want to fly. Or some will drive halfway across the country because they don't want to fly. And that's totally up to them, you know, however you want to do it, whatever works. But you make all of those plans. You get your tickets, if you're flying or going by train. You take care of all of those physical things. And, you know, if you're going internationally like we are, you make sure the passport's up to date. Can't come up to right before the feast and, oh, my passport's expired, or I don't have a passport. You got to think ahead. You got to plan all these physical details. And that's a big part of planning for the feast as well. Notify credit cards. Okay, I'm going out of state. You know, I'm traveling. Especially if you're traveling international. Hey, we're going internationally. When you see these things come in Jamaica, don't decline my credit card. You know, I am going to be there for a little while. So you try to let people know. You try to make whatever preparations you need to make. So, again, I'm not going to focus a lot on that physical side. Third, and most importantly, we need to prepare spiritually. That's what I want to focus on the most in this. That we're prepared spiritually for the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, you've heard things about this as we've come up to the Feast of Tabernacles already. So a lot of this will be, in one sense, repeating what we're already aware of. But I put this in the point or in the mode of 3 points. How do we focus spiritually? What do we do to prepare spiritually for the feast? What are the things we need to be thinking about as we prepare spiritually for the feast? Well, first of all, I would say we need to focus on God's direct, miraculous intervention in our lives. God's direct, miraculous intervention in our lives. You remember when God gave the instruction about this upcoming feast, the Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day, which are kind of the big things in this fall festival season, God reminded Israel that he had brought them out of Egypt and that on the way they had seen God's direct intervention. Let's go to Leviticus 23 where he talks about the Feast of Tabernacles. Leviticus chapter 23. Now, they were in temporary dwellings as they journeyed through the wilderness to the Promised Land. Originally, it seems that it would have been a shorter trip, but they ended up spending 40 years getting there because of their rebellion, sadly. It ended up being a lot longer than it should have been. But here in Leviticus chapter 23, let's pick it up in verse 42. Verse 42. Again, he talks about the Feast of Tabernacles earlier. It starts in verse 34, but he comes back to make some comments here in verse 42. He says, "You shall dwell in booths," or temporary dwellings, and we do that today by staying in a, you know, a motel or a hotel or condo or someone else, or rent a house or where, whatever we stay in at the feast. But he said, "You shall dwell in these temporary dwellings for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths," or temporary dwellings, "when I brought them out of the land of Egypt." God brought them out of the land of Egypt. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't something they did. God miraculously intervened to free them from captivity in Egypt. And he miraculously provided for them as they made their way through the promised land. Remember the manna every day, except the Sabbath, twice as much on Friday. But day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, God directly provided for their needs as he took them from Egypt to the promised land. So God was directly involved in their traveling, in their lives, in their move to the promised land. You know, God does the same thing for us. Many times he intervenes in our physical life. And if we're looking for it, we can often see those things. I think it was Mr. Trotter not too long ago gave a sermon about small blessings, looking for those small blessings in our lives. But even beyond just the physical things that he does for us, he's done way more spiritually for us, because he's freed us spiritually. He's freed us from the penalty of sin, those sins that we've repented of. He frees us from that kind of slavery. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Let's look at what Paul said to the church in Corinth. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. There are a number of analogies that Paul used in describing the blessing of understanding what we do, understanding about God's festivals, understanding the New Testament meaning of them. That the harvest that this fall festival pictures is not a physical harvest. It's not of physical grain. It's of people being harvested, being brought into the family of God. God's plan of salvation is to add more to his family. That's his whole goal. The book of Hebrews makes that very clear, that Jesus Christ had that as the goal when he came. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, notice what he says in verse 9. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 9, "But as it's written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed them to us through his Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of the man that is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God. Now we've received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit that is from God, that we may know the things that have been freely given to us by God." God has blessed us. He has given us an understanding. He has given us knowledge. That's not something we came up with on our own. God has to open our eyes to be able to see this, to be able to see the spiritual analogies of the festivals and what they mean, what they picture. That's an incredible blessing, to be able to take away that veil so that people can understand. This is what Paul was talking about, having our eyes opened. He talks about in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, that veil that Satan has cast over the nations. 2 Corinthians chapter 3. And one of the biggest blessings God can give any human being is the opening of our eyes to understand his word, to understand his plan for mankind. We've been incredibly blessed by God to be able to do that. Here in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, as Paul wrote his second letter to them, notice what he says beginning in verse 14. He is drawing an analogy from what Moses did in the Old Testament. Remember when Moses went up the mountain and spoke with God and saw the backside of God? When he came down, his face was glowing. The children of Israel were frightened of him, so he put a veil over his face to shield his face so people couldn't see that it was glowing. When he went in to talk to God, he took the veil off. When he came back out, he put it back on. So he's doing the opposite, kind of the reverse on this. Verse 13, "Unlike Moses, who put a veil over his face so the children of Israel could not look steadfastly at the end of what was passing away. But verse 14 says, but their minds were blinded. For until this day, the same veil remains unlifted in the reading of the Old Testament, because the veil is taken away in Christ. But even to this day, when Moses is read, a veil lies on their heart. Nevertheless, when one turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. So see, he's saying there was a veil, in a sense, a blinding of the eyes, like a veil over the face, that kept Israel of the first century, the Jews of the first century, from understanding what he was talking about, and what Jesus Christ was talking about. Kept them from understanding the truth. So they were blinded. They weren't able to see. They weren't able to understand. Our eyes are blessed because they've been opened. We've had that veil removed. As God begins to show us and work with us and help us understand what he's doing with mankind, what he's doing with us, our part in this. He offers us an incredible part in helping him accomplish his goal of accomplishing and working with him. Let's go also to Romans chapter 8. Notice what Paul says to the group of Christians in Rome. Romans chapter 8. Speaking again to those who are baptized and have the Spirit of God dwelling in them. Verse 16, he says, the Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs. This is Romans 8, verse 17. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. Think about how incredible that is. Joint heirs with Christ. Whatever Christ is going to inherit, we inherit along with him. As brothers in God's family. Joint heirs with Christ. If indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. For I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. We have that promise of glory, being changed to spirit, being a part of the family of God, inheriting alongside Jesus Christ. Again, all of that's based on his involvement in our lives, his direct involvement, personal involvement in our life, that we have this opportunity. So, as we think about the fall festivals and as we go to the Feast of Tabernacles, I think it's very good for us to focus on that. Focus on God's direct miraculous intervention. Now, my parents began listening to The World Tomorrow in the early 1950s. A lot of our other extended family members began listening at the same time. And I think I've mentioned several times, what is it about my parents, when they listened, they looked at their Bible and they said, that's right, I hadn't seen that before. I need to do something about this. I need to change my thinking. The Lutheran Church taught me this. Here's what the Bible says. It's something else. I need to believe the Bible, not what I grew up being taught. What made that switch in their mind that they were willing to do that? For the rest of our family members, extended family, that's interesting. What's up next? It's just no interest in it. That's God's direct involvement in opening their eyes to say, this is different. I need to read. I need to believe what I read. Again, God's direct involvement in our lives. Think about that. Focus on that. Second part of spiritual preparation. We already read this in Deuteronomy 14. Learn to respect and fear God. He said, come and rejoice before me. But do that so you learn to fear me. Not fear in the sense of terror. I mean, we know what will happen if we don't obey him, if we thumb our nose at him, and that's not a good end result. But it's more about respect. We respect him and we fear him. Look at Exodus chapter 3. There was, again, some instruction for ancient Israel. We look to this instruction for what it means to us today, how this would apply to us in the 21st century. The principles are the same. The principles don't change. The direct application does. They were going to worship God in the tabernacle and later in a temple. This is not a tabernacle. It's not a temple. It's not an Old Testament replica of what they did in the Old Testament. But it is a house of worship. It is our place of worship on the Sabbath and on the holy days. Exodus chapter 3. Let's pick it up in verse 4. Exodus 3 and verse 4. So when the Lord saw that he, Moses, turned aside to look, this was when he first, when God first began working with Moses, when there was this burning bush. When he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, "Moses, Moses." Let's see if I can do my, "Moses, Moses." I don't think that's quite it, but that's my best attempt. And he said, "Here I am." And God said, "Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Show honor and respect to me, Moses. Where I am is holy. Nothing else on the earth is, but I'm right here in this bush right now. This is holy. Take your shoes off. Don't trample on what's holy." There's the principle, isn't it? Don't trample on what is holy. If God says this is holy, treat it as holy. Respect it as holy. God says the Sabbath was something he set aside from creation as a holy day. Do we treat it as holy? When we come together to meet and worship God as a group, it is a holy convocation. God calls his feast days holy convocations. Do we treat them as holy? Do we give them the honor and the respect they deserve? Do we do that? Leviticus chapter 26. Here's a chapter that, this is really one of those chapters, or several of them, that talk about blessings and cursings. But Leviticus chapter 26. Well, let's pick it up in verse 2. Leviticus 26 and verse 2. He says, "You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence, treat with respect, reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and perform them, then I will give you rain in its season. The land shall yield its produce. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall last till the time of vintage. And the vintage shall last till the time of sowing." I mean, this is incredible produce that he's talking about. You'll still be harvesting when it's time to plant again. I'm going to pour out blessings on you you won't even be able to believe. Verse 6, "I will give peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none will make you afraid. I will rid the land of evil beasts, and the sword will not go through your land." Remind you of something we read in some of the minor prophets? Like Micah 4, same thing. "I'm going to give you peace. I will bless you." If we reverence his name, if we treat his church services as special, how do we do that? How do we reverence? How do we reverence God's meetings? Well, we come on time. We dress decently. We try to look presentable before God, wear things that are modest as becomes Christians. And we treat wherever we meet with respect. It means when we go to a rented hall, we don't trash it. We clean up afterwards. We take care of it. People comment many times about how well we take care for their property. Why do we do that? Because when we're there, we look at it as this is where God's name is. If God is here, I need to treat this with respect. I want to treat the property with respect. It's not our property. It belongs to somebody else, but we are there to worship God, which means we need to set an example. That's our way of thinking. That's our approach to it. We don't leave a bunch of trash around. We don't let our children run wild and run into people. We try to treat it with respect. So that's part of learning to fear and honor and respect God, is when we show honor to him and when we reverence our meeting places. As God says, "Reverence my sanctuary," in verse 2. We treat it with honor. We treat it with respect, like we treat God with respect. Matthew chapter 22, let's turn to the New Testament. Look at a statement here, Matthew chapter 22. Jesus was asked about what's really important. What is the greatest commandment? We'll see that Matthew 22, verse 34, talks about the Pharisees saw that he had silenced the Sadducees with his answers. And one of the Pharisees then came up with a question. He was a lawyer. And we know how lawyers can be. Ask the question in a tricky manner and see if you can get him to trip up and say something wrong. So he was testing him. We're told that in the text here. One of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him, and saying, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? What's the most important thing? I just want one commandment. Tell me what the most important one is." And Jesus' answer in verse 37 was, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment." And the second, he wasn't done. I watch lawyer shows sometimes or court shows and they cut them off. Oh, that's it. Thank you. Jesus was not being cut off. He kept going. "And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Well, that's all the law and the prophets. They all hang on that. Love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. Two great commandments. It means we think about other people. We think about their needs. We think about serving and helping them. Not just serving ourselves. See, this is all part of learning to respect and fear God, that we learn to look at things the way God looks at things. And we learn to treat Him with respect, and we learn to treat other people with respect. Helping, serving, assisting them. Romans, again, let's go to Romans chapter 12 this time. Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12 and verse 1. Many of us have this verse memorized. But Paul, as he's writing to the church there, said, "I beseech you, therefore." This is an earnest request. This isn't just kind of a passing thing. This is earnest. "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." That you present yourselves a living sacrifice. You know, the life of a Christian is supposed to be a life of service. We read in many passages in the Bible about serving, about helping, about taking care of other people. Our feast needs to be that way too. Are you going to serve at the feast? If so, how? What are you going to do? Some people say, "Oh, I've served for years. You know, I'll let somebody else do it. I'm just going to go have a vacation." You know, every time I hear anything related to that, it's like, that's not what the feast is about. The feast is about the kingdom of God and what that kingdom is going to be like. Do you really think the kingdom of God is going to be people sitting back waiting for other people to give to them? Or is it going to be about teaching people you need to give, treat your neighbor, love your neighbor as yourself, go out of your way to help your neighbor? Don't say your car doesn't work. "Sorry, can't help you." You go try to help them, don't you, Mr. Ellis? Even if you're not quite qualified at the time to be able to fix their car, you still have that desire to serve. You have that desire to help. That's the attitude of God. That's what a Christian life is all about. You know, and it's not just about the official ways. Yes, there are official ways to serve, ushering and count and parking, all kinds of different ways you can serve officially at the feast. But think about all the ways you can serve unofficially. Just go talk to people. You see somebody by themselves, go talk to them. Encourage them. You see a mom loaded down with diaper bags and books, go help her. Help her get her and her kids to the car. I mean, there's so many ways we can help. Take a widow out to eat. Pick up songbooks. The ways are innumerable that you can help other people. Maybe it's just praying for people. You see someone and talk to someone who needs help, pray for them. Let them know you're praying for them. That's even more helpful, isn't it? That they know someone's praying for them. They're thinking about them. They're caring about them. And they're asking God to assist and help that person. There are all kinds of ways to serve. Well, I have to confess, my personal worst feast ever. Yeah, we always talk about the best feast ever. my personal worst feast ever was a year I did nothing to serve at the feast. Only one year I said, I'll never make that mistake again. I got the least out of that feast, of any feast of my life, as an adult. I said, I'll never do that again. As long as I'm able, I will serve in some way or another, even if it's just praying. If I get to the point that I can't move around, I can't do anything, at least I will pray. And praying is a great benefit and a help to people. Believe me, talk to people who've had others pray for them. It'll make a believer out of you. It really is a blessing and a help to people. Okay, so we focus on God's intervention. We learn to respect and fear Him. Third point I have is simply this. Always keep His plan in mind. Always keep that big picture of God's plan in mind. Sometimes I've heard sermons at the feast reminding us, hey, think of the big picture. Look at the big picture. We're just a little part of God's enormous plan of salvation that ultimately is going to involve all mankind. Sooner or later, He's going to give everybody a chance for salvation. Even those people, billions of people who've lived and died, never heard the name Jesus Christ. Eventually, He's going to give them a chance for salvation. And a chance to have Jesus Christ's sacrifice applied to their sins. That's especially important thinking in a big picture in our spiritual lives. You know, as I was researching some things about Feast of Trumpets, preparing a message for the Feast of Trumpets, I ran across a number of things that were kind of interesting to me as I thought about all of these fall festivals. Because different writers in different commentaries were trying to come up with something meaningful for trumpets. What does it mean? Now, we look at the trumpets, we realize we make the connections to the trumpets, the trumpet plagues in the book of Revelation. We make the connection to 1 Corinthians 15, 1 Thessalonians 4 that talk about the resurrection at Christ's return, the sound of that final trump, that trumpet blast that will announce His return. We see those connections. They don't. They don't get those connections. So they're trying to come up with something else. But I did find this interesting. One particular writer said, well, you know, seven is a number, reading the Bible, looking through the Bible. Seven's a number that's important to God. It's kind of a number of completion. It got me thinking along those lines. What all do these feasts in this seventh month of God's sacred calendar, what all do they picture? And what all does seven look at? What does that mean in terms of completion? God rested on the seventh day of creation week, signifying His physical creation was completed. It was finished. It was done. And He rested on that seventh day and placed His name in it, sanctified it. Every seventh day from then on is a reflection of the creation week. In ancient Israel, He said every 7 years, in that seventh year, forgive debts. Let's complete the financial, economic sequence. The end of that sixth year, you enter the seventh year, all debts are forgiven. Wow, what a difference that would make, wouldn't it, in our society, if debts only went up to the start of that seventh year and then they were forgiven. You start over again. Talk about an economic windfall for people. Now, of course, people will think, well, I can only loan this to you till the seventh year, and then it's forgiven, so I need to think, can I give this away? If so, I'll do it, because I may not get it back. It would change a lot of thinking in people's minds, wouldn't it? But the seventh year was a year of release. It was in the seventh month, actually it was on the Day of Atonement, that the Jubilee was to be sounded. You would go seven of those seven-year systems, seven-year cycles, and at the end of the 49th year, seven times seven, was a 50th year. And the 50th year was a year of Jubilee. And if anybody had sold land or had, for one reason or another, that reverted back to the families. So you had a full 50-year total recycle of everybody moving back to their own properties, their own areas of the promised land where God had said, this is this tribe's property. So again, the seventh year, it was the completion of seven of those seven-year cycles. We think about the festivals in the fall, the seventh holy day in God's festival cycle is the seventh festival, the last great day. It completes that cycle of festivals for this year. And then we'll start again next year. It signifies the completion of God's plan of salvation for mankind too, doesn't it? Because it is that last great day that pictures all of mankind who has not had a chance for salvation coming up in a resurrection and being given a time period in which you can choose. Here's what you missed out on when you lived before. You had no clue about Jesus Christ. You had no clue about my plan of salvation. Here's your choice. Accept what I'm saying and have a chance to be a part of the family of God, or reject it. And that'll simply be it. Again, the completion. Mr. Franks mentioned in his member letter that he's made it a habit to focus on the fall festivals, to try to get a spiritual perspective and keep that big picture in mind. He said he tries to make it a habit to fast a day or two before the feast. And we all fast on atonement. So you've already fasted. Wouldn't hurt to put another day aside sometimes. It's kind of hard now. I mean, we're feast starts tomorrow. But I thought that was a really good point that he made, that it's to get our minds on the spiritual aspect. So keep God's plan in mind. Now again, these are not new concepts or ideas. You've probably heard most of these points before. Maybe I've given you a little bit different approach to them, or a little different perspective on them. But in the church, we've made a big deal out of preparing for the Feast of Tabernacles. It's because it is a big deal. These fall festivals are really important to God. They are the highlight of the year. I want to go to Colossians chapter 3 as we wrap this up. They're the spiritual highlight of the year for us. Colossians chapter 3. Paul makes this statement in the first couple of verses. Colossians 3, verse 1, "If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth." That's where our focus needs to be, is on the spiritual aspects of our life. Now, do we have to take care of the physical? Do you have to put the trash out? Do you have to take care of paying bills and all those physical? Oh, sure you do. Obviously, we have to. But in our minds, do we keep that big perspective? Do we keep the spiritual perspective? That's what is most important. Yes, we do physical preparations to get ready for the feast financially, and then doing all kinds of physical preparations, physical planning. But most of all, we need to do the spiritual preparation. We need to come with the perspective of taking our sandals off to realize God has made this time holy on the holy days, on the Sabbath. We need to treat it that way. Anything with God's name in it deserves great honor and respect from us. That's how we learn to rejoice before God and learn to properly fear Him when we go to His feast. Hope you all have a wonderful feast.